When we dance, the journey itself is the point. When we play music, you will simply become completely absorbed in sound. And therefore you will find yourself living in an eternal now in which there is no past and there is no future and there is no thing called difference between yourself and the world of nature outside you.
Welcome to the ThinkSpace podcast with myself, John Staskowski and Danny Massaro, where we discuss human nature and the practical application of philosophy. To find out more about our cohort course and membership community, please head over to www.thinkspace.academy. We hope you enjoy this episode.
This is red. This is green. This is something. This is nothing. This is solid. This is space. Between yourself and the world of nature outside you.
Right, Danny, hopefully this episode will be a little bit more fun and exciting than the title might suggest, and I think it will, but we are going to explore some of the ideas of Ernest Becker, and the start point for that is his book that he wrote in 1973 called The Denial of Death, which was actually a Pulitzer Prize winning book, although as people are probably used to, my rating and review for it wasn't that good, but we'll maybe see why. So essentially Becker's key thesis in The Denial of Death was basically that our fundamental motivation in life is not simply to survive, but to forget and escape death, which, like I said, sounds very dark, but we'll try and lighten it up for the listeners. And the reason Becker thought that was that basically we're the only animals on Earth who actually know that we're going to die. So most animals, if you think, they just encounter the world as it is. So they encounter the world as they find it, and it's almost just like an instinctive reaction to the world that they find in front of them. However, because we've got consciousness and this ability for like higher order thinking, we can actually do things like imagine things that don't exist, and we can imagine things in the future and then actually create them and design them and then, you know, come up with them. And for Becker, that was a key difference between us and animals. However, if you are smart enough to do that, so if you're smart enough to know that you are here, you're therefore smart enough to know that you will die. And not that you'll die, but that you could basically die at any moment for any reason that could often be just totally out of your control. So Becker was essentially saying that, look, this is like a bit of a neurosis that other animals just don't have. And if we were to really think about this carefully, so if this was in your day-to-day thinking, Becker was saying, look, you wouldn't be able to get out of bed in the morning. You'd just be crushed by this existential weight of knowing that you were going to die and you could die at any moment. So really what Becker was then making the case for in this book that was we essentially try and manage that feeling by embracing like cultural worldviews, for example. So we come up with beliefs that we share with other people in our group, like our social group, and by feeling that we're part of this like shared reality, that helps us reduce this death anxiety a little bit, gives us this sense of life having a meaning and that we've got value. And Becker said that if you do have that sense of, look, you're a person who has that value, he called that then self-esteem. So you have this self-esteem, and all that does then is really just lifts this weight of this existential dread, essentially, that you're going to die at some point. So that was really the thesis of the book, and we're going to delve into some of the ins and outs of it a little bit. Do you want to give us your initial thoughts, Danny, on just when you... We've talked about this book for a little while now, haven't we? Probably a few years. So what were your initial gut reactions, just thoughts and feelings when you came across this concept of human beings denying the fact that we're going to die at some point?
Yeah, well, firstly, that was really well explained, that. Well done.
For once.
Yeah, the first time, you know, you hear the word, for me anyway, death, you think, oh God, I don't want to do any philosophy where I'm thinking about death. Like, you know, like, life is too short. It's that kind of thing, isn't it? Like, just be jolly. And why would you go there? So it's a bit like, even if you're listening to this now, you might think it's like having a nasty sort of tasting bit of Marmite or something. And then like you start to grow to like it, you know, it actually starts to be useful. It's nice. It's, you know, it's nutritional or whatever. It's like a bit of an instant bad taste. But when you come out the other side, it's actually quite relieving and rewarding. And it's a little bit like the sunny nihilism feeling that you get at the end. It's like, oh God, yeah, I faced up to it a bit. And then I've opened my mind back to the fact that I talked about this a bit, and it's horrific and horrendous. And I will never actually know how I feel about death until it's about to personally actually happen? You know, did that strange? But nevertheless, the theory of it, a couple of things came that I found really useful. The biggest thing I found useful from it was this thing that man can't really handle his littleness, how small he actually is, of how finite you are. So he needs constant meaning to make up for this, you know. And the meaning isn't just, you know, you want to count. You know, you want, whilst you're here on the earth, you almost want to count and be a bit like, well, I'm mattered, you know, and I'm because I know I'm going to die, I have to use this time. Now, if you never died, you know, the film Highlander.
I've never watched it. I know the one you mean. I've never actually watched it, you know.
Oh, yeah. Well, for anyone in the 80s and thing, you know, Highlander was about, you know, people who didn't die, you know, immortals, and they always went through that. If you know there's no end, there's no time limit, you can't die, kind of thing. I mean, I think they could if something happened to them in particular with their heads or something. But if you couldn't die, no matter what, it kind of changes everything. But we know we've got a limited period of time. So that's always in play in a weird way in the background, like an app running in the background, what he called a bit of a neurosis. And that's what kind of makes us human. That obviously you said, well, animals don't have. So you're going along and you're thinking, right, well, I've got to try and in some level, if you're a bit of a thinker, you know, and you're conscious, you're going along and you're like, well, I want to count. I want to be special. My biological existence, and this is the bit I found really like, thought, oh, what a great way of saying that. My biological existence, I know it's going to go, but my symbolic existence could live forever as long as people are around on the planet, you know, through books and legacy and my children and their children and their children and, you know, and all of that stuff. So it was like, what we do in life is really, we hammer the symbolic part to make up for the biological limits. And I was like, wow, that's what, like, in a way, that's what pro athletes are doing. So people with projects, people who go out and create brilliant things and they're energized, you know, the Marcus Aurelius thing of what you do in life echoes in eternity. Like, you're working all the time in a way on your symbolic self. And we talked about that in the status podcast as well, didn't we? That when your status goes and your symbolism drops through the floor, for example, for something, then it's almost like you have died. And therefore, when you are symbolic part of you isn't going well, you know, for example, you have children and you think, well, in a way, I'm going to live on, you know, because I've had children and they're going to like live on. Your fear becomes really, really protective around those children or your projects or your theories or whatever it happens to be, if people come along and threaten them, because it's a bit like, in a way, what your symbolic self is feels to you as you live as important as your biological self, until obviously your biology starts malfunctioning, which tends not to happen as much, you know, when you get ill or something like that, and that changes everything. Perhaps when you get biologically ill, you know, or something takes over and your body's going to die sooner than it perhaps could have, perhaps that's when you actually in a way see through some of your symbolic projects as what's all that actually about. But take faith and take encouragement at heart in some of your legacy, in your children, and in how you're going to carry on. And the three ways in which you know you might do that are by coming up with a creative solution to that, a romantic one, solution about the world and your contributions, but also religious solutions, you know, the afterlife and all of those things. So I thought that was really interesting and useful, actually. And I'll talk about that later in terms of athletes and sports people when they're about to retire.
You definitely get that with athletes with the name, don't you? Your name becomes like everything almost, where it's like, that's what's going to live on afterwards. I suppose, like, if you imagine like a golf clubhouse and you have like the big tournaments, your name's there, isn't it? And it's literally engraved on a trophy and stuff.
Yeah.
And that is going to live on forever. So you can see why people have that tension of, you know, when if they do something wrong or like they make a cock up and it's like your name gets dragged through the mud a little bit, that brings a big stress, doesn't it? Like, because then that's not, it's been tarnished a little bit, almost like the name that you're going to leave behind, that's been kind of pulled in. But I know what you're saying about the body as well. I think though, a key thing with Becker, what he was, and how this gets almost forced back into your subconscious, is that you're well aware of your physical being. So you're well aware of your body when you're ill or when you've got an injury and that kind of thing. But also there's this aspect of like, well, a comet could just slam into the planet at any moment. and just evaporate me. And he was sort of saying that's always at play in your subconscious, the back of your mind, that you know it's not even, it's not just that physical, oh, well, if I look after myself, eat well, exercise, I'll like live till I'm 90 or whatever. It's like that's out of your hands, like a bus could just like smash you, you know, when you cross, like, obvious things like that. And that's more in your subconscious, I think, where it's constantly just gnawing away at the background. So part of the way we behave is to keep that suppressed and pushed back and down, yeah, as far away from like conscious thought as possible.
Yeah, I think we've done stuff on meaning, haven't we? And life's about meaning. And when you don't have meaning, you can feel depressed because you're almost like, I'm insignificant. What's the point of me? What's been the point of me being here? These things can maybe catch up later in life as you start reflecting, you know, in the form of regrets and wasted time and things you didn't say and things you could have done and so on. So all these things are there because you know the end is in play. Yeah, if you just live forever, it's like, well, I'll get to that one day, and you never have that feeling of like time's running out and so on. So what, again, this thing about, you know, building your symbolic self, what you stand for, your reputation, what you feel about yourself, like you say, your self-esteem, in a way, the three areas that creative thing. So that would be like create a creative solution to the death anxiety that's lurking deep down, or the impermanence, you know, what you might call impermanence, the fear of insignificance and impermanence that you kind of know. One of them is the creative solution of like art. So if you produce art, or you're a musician, or you've made something useful that way that helps other people in artistic terms, you could come up with things that will maybe, even in science in a way, you know, you've been the person who made a drug that helped everybody, or you were a person who, you know, cured a disease, or you were the person who built prosthetics that now help people walk. Whatever it is, you've made a contribution, you will live on, you know, and you'll be remembered. So that's like, and same with music, and like George Michael was saying on a documentary I saw the other day, he said, you know, long after I've gone and long after this, people will remember my music, they won't remember that I was gay, or what I've said about this, or I went in the toilet. And he said that like right in the moment. So he was using this kind of theory to actually make that present moment he was in feel better. With me back with my pragmatic head on, it's like, no, you know, you are actually going, this isn't going to solve, these solutions aren't going to solve the fact that you're going to feel frightened and all the horrendous downs of illnesses and deaths and all them, and that horrible pointlessness and all that fear. But as you sort of go along in normal times, when it's popping up now and again out of nowhere, and you're getting those little weird moments of anxiety, maybe you can take solace in the fact that you will live on with your art projects, and people will remember you for things like George Michael did there. The obvious one is the religious one, isn't it? You know, where, you know, you go into religion and all religions all the time, you believe in things like the soul, the afterlife, heaven, you know, a place that you go to, and that you will meet the people that you've lost, and they're waiting for you, and all these things that can take the pressure off. So religion can take a massive, really useful, excellent function for people. So that's another sort of create, you know, Becca was saying that's basically why, you know, we admire people who've come back from death, tell us, and like Jesus, and all, there's usually one in every religion who's managed to do it. Dante's Inferno was another one, wasn't it, where, you know, it was like they went into all the bits of the afterlife and hell, and they came back, and yeah, you kind of admire that in myths and stuff and hero stories, where people seem to have conquered death and conquered the fear of death, and it's like someone to look up to and associate with a bit and give you a bit of encouragement. But then the other one was romantic, that, you know, things like love. Whilst you're here, you can be spiritual and you can love the world and you can love people, and people will remember you through love and the kind of person you were, not necessarily what you did. You know, that saying of they won't remember what you did, but remember how you made them feel. So people can live like that. And that reminded me of the person who wrote about those obituary values. You know, the guy, it was an American guy, once he'd studied obituaries, and most people in the obituaries write about what the person was like as a person more than they write about what they achieved. You might say, you know, Albert Einstein, you know, did he, you know, mass this and that, but, you know, in reality, Ryan was a lovely man, I did this, I did that. And it's like, which one do you want? Do you want, you know, values associated with what you did, or do you want values associated with the kind of person you were and people? So again, that's like, if you that can really shape your life, because you can go, no, I want to get busy in my early life, or I want to get busy achieving something like practical and creating something that will help people forever that way and that I'll be known for. But then there's another side. It's like, no, I don't have to do all of that. I could just be a nice person to people, and the people who knew me will remember me for that.
That's a huge one in academia, you know. The amount of people who, because, especially now since I've left and stuff, but it's only getting worse, you know, that kind of publish or perish kind of vibe where you've got to be constantly publishing in journals and getting articles out there. And it just becomes a race of like who's got the most citations, who's got the most publications. So you're just obsessed with getting that out. Yeah. And there must be some of this in play with it where it's like, that's my legacy. I'm going to leave like all this work behind, all this research and all these ideas that's going to have my name attached to it. But it's like, yeah, but if a lot of people don't really like you that much because you're a bit of an arse and you're not that nice to be around, that's what they're going to remember ultimately. What's the difference between 200 papers and 400 papers if you were a bit of a dick? That's what's going to kind of be remembered to you. Yeah, I see that definitely in academia. I presume sport can be the same as well, can't it? Anything where it's cutthroat, I suppose. And there's a status game involved as well where it's top trump.
I think the good thing with the Becker thing, he's not saying, so you idiot, stop it. He's just saying, so like, I can see what you're up to. I don't blame you for it.
Well, that was part of his thesis again, was that, so he highlights this issue, but then he's sort of saying, you know, so that's what we do to deal with it. This is how we keep that tamped down a little bit in our subconscious, but there's consequences to it. So, I mean, one thing, I wouldn't particularly recommend the book. I found the book really hard work. It seemed to be one of those where you could make the central point in probably a chapter, and then the rest of the book is basically like justifying this thesis. So he goes down some really strange rabbit holes that we'll probably touch on in a little while. But another book that's been written since, called The Worm at the Core, on the Role of Death in Life, and that's by Sheldon Solomon and some of his colleagues. They basically pick up Becker's work, so that theory of there's this denial of death, and they were like, all right, we love this, we think this is really interesting. Can we actually do some research and studies to see if we can prove that this actually exists empirically? So that's what they did, and that book, I'd recommend that book. That's a really good read. It's a lot more reader-friendly and brings it to life with practical examples and stuff. But essentially, they found that, yeah, what Becker was suggesting does play out in empirical studies. And they then came up with their own theory called terror management theory, which was basically the empirical evidence of Becker's ideas, which they then present in this book. So they do all sorts of different studies in loads of different scenarios and contexts. And a lot of them, it was basically all they would do is like just remind you that you're going to die. So they'd have some kind of a condition set up, and then they would like have a control group where they said nothing, and then the other group, there'd be some sort of a subtle reminder that you were going to die. And it'd be even daft stuff like they'd drive past a funeral parlour on the way to this task or something. So it's not even like explicitly said, just little subliminal reminder, just to remind you that you are finite and you're going to die. And it's like, and lo and behold, they found that it played out. So this death anxiety, as soon as you bring that up again, it alters how people behave massively. I think certainly in more recent years, they've done a lot around work in politics, for example, when you're looking at things like voting intentions and then just like your political views and everything. And it might be things like views on immigrants, for example. If you remind someone of death before doing some of these studies, it would be things like you would sit closer to someone of the same race as yourself, for example, and you'd put distance between yourself and, say, like immigrants or refugees who look differently to you, as an example. Literally just by that sort of reminder that you're going to die. And then they go into loads of different studies where they play this out with, you know, like Trump and all that stuff in America, and just like, if you remind people of death, they're much more likely to vote for like a strong messiah type figure who's going to sort everyone's problems out and is going to like make America great again and all that. You're much more attracted to those kind of characters.
Do you think when Trump came out this week, wasn't it, he did a thing and he said, I can sort out the Ukraine war in one day. Well, then I thought, oh, but he's not all bad then if he gets back in, go on, Donald. And I don't like the guy. So that what you're saying is, because it's on your mind, obviously everyone's mind a bit, that, you know,
this is... Yeah, and they're talking about nuclear war and Armageddon, and those sorts of words are actually in the media thing, isn't it? It's like nuclear Armageddon.
Trump can go, I can sort that out. I know, I like getting on with both guys. I could stop that in a day. It's attractive, isn't it?
But if you remember with Trump at the time, it was like building a wall, keeping them out and us in and looking after us. And it's all about America first. And that all plays to this sense. So essentially, a lot of that terror management research, it found that that death anxiety amplifies hostility, basically. So you're much more hostile to people who are different to you. So remember, we said, like Becca said, one of the ways that we deal with it is getting these shared cultural views and beliefs that you feel that you're part of something that has meaning. So if you remind people of death, and that death anxiety rears its head up, they're much more intolerant of other people who are not part of their culture and who, for example, don't hold the same beliefs as them. Because if someone doesn't hold the same belief as you, they're basically saying, well, you're wrong. And if what you think's wrong, that means that this whole death anxiety can just run free again because you're not really moved to anything solid anymore. You don't have that cultural basis. So then you don't have the self-esteem and everything and all that.
Point I remember it was that I found interesting was that if someone picks holes in your symbolic self, which are your opinions, your arguments, your beliefs, what you've constructed, you know, I've been a professional sports athlete and it's meaningful as anything, and I believe the hype that I am a bit of a demigod because I, you know, play professional sport and I've won that gold medal now, so I am basically a higher being than everybody who hasn't. If you pick that and shatter that down to absurdity and actually means nothing, it can really hurt you because you've built your symbolic self on that, which is you to you. Is you, it actually is just as much as you as it feels as your biological self. In fact, more so, because you sort of live in your head, you know, you might say that and you just take your body for granted. So that was interesting. Yeah, I could see why people get so protective and argue about this or that and dig in, because if there's holes blown in that theory or there's might be debate around it, it feels physically shattering. And it's like someone, it's not like literally killing you, but, you know, they're sucking the meaning out of you, which is feels like depressing, which in a weird way is killing you, isn't it? You know, because it hits your body and it hits your existence and your energy and your motivation.
And that's what this research found. They were basically saying in a couple of the papers I read that the best politicians basically turn that fear into hatred. And that's like one of, there was a really interesting stat. I meant to look up the figures, but it was basically talking about George Bush. And apparently he had the lowest poll ratings in history for an American president. And then 9/11 happened, and he went from that to the highest after 3 weeks. And they were essentially making the point that something as visceral as that, where, you know, like this foreign invader or threat has come right into our backyard and done something this, like, horrific. He was then brilliant at turning that just fear of the people into him. It's like, right, let's go and have a war. And then everyone's like, yeah, we're having it, let's have a war. And they can justify anything then, because it's turning that fear into hate. There was a quote by George Bernard Shaw. I don't know what he wrote it in, but it was in one of his, I think he was a playwright, wasn't he? And he said, when the angel of death sounds his trumpet, the pretenses of civilization are blown from men's heads into the mud like hats in a gust of wind. And it's that sense of, like, as soon as there's fear on, you'll do anything to protect your own, like feeling of, like, we're part of, we've got shared culture beliefs, and the other is wrong, so you can justify anything.
I'll tell you two things that come to mind there. The toxicity at Everton Football Club in the pants. You're going to die, you're going to go down. Right. All goes wrong. The vitriol and the hatred, the half-iron at the board, that's become popular in football, hasn't it? You know, even Liverpool this season, it's the board's fault now, because, you know, a bit more than last season. In fact, it happens really fast. It's like that if not, you know, symbolic death, we're going to get relegated, we're not the team we once were, we're dying, no one thinks we're any good, we can't. And then it gets really, really proper personal hatred. Now, the other thing I'm going to ask you then is, so when COVID happened and we were getting hit on the news with all the deaths coming in, you know, from Italy on the TV in Britain anyway, and then New York and burying the bodies, and then in England obviously seeing all the wards, and like, it was interesting, wasn't it? Like, I look back now and I'm like, gosh, you know, like, if the postman turned up, I was spraying him down antiseptic, you know, God, don't touch that mail. And Laura was going off to, you know, buy shopping like she was going on a...
My mum's still disinfecting her shopping to this day. She's still, honestly, my dad will bring the shopping in and she will still disinfect. And I say that to her, I was like, do you realise how mental that is?
Yes.
And she's like, well, it is, I just don't trust life.
Becca would say that is really, or these people, terror management in a way, because it's been brought, the George Bernard Shaw, you go a bit irrational and you go super, when you're faced with reminders of randomness and you could be attacked, and it could, that's where you sort of lose your marbles a little bit, and
yeah.
Not lose your marbles, your behavior changes and sort of go like down the levels pretty fast.
I definitely think COVID really brought into stark like focus death, didn't it? It was on your TV every single day, 24/7. It was all people were talking to you. It's like, then it was like lockdowns, you couldn't, all the stuff. That was like full on 24/7 death. You weren't keeping that in your subconscious, were you? It was like just in your face.
Yes.
So you can see why people would start to lose the plot in a way, and you could see why people would do things that would just seem absurd even a few weeks before, because all that fear of death was just swirling constantly in front of them. And you saw it with people, like the way they behaved. And
yeah, and then you had all the vaccines and I need it solved. So the vaccines were tempting, and then it was...
But also remember that fear of other. So it was like, say, I don't know, it was like young people versus old, wasn't it? And it was like, we must protect the old people. So it was then you could imagine older people really feeling quite fearful of young people. And you could see them going, yeah, shut down the schools. They're spreading it there. Don't let them in supermarket. All that fear turns into hating the other. And that could be your next door neighbour. Like some of the stuff I saw and heard within families, like people turning on their own families because they were so fearful, and it just becomes into, see, then you can, part of the terror management research, they were saying like, yeah, that's how things like genocides happen. Like, it's not as actually unlikely as you think. If you're that fearful of some other threat or some other person because they differ in the beliefs to yours, that's where you can get like, right, well, we're just going to eradicate that whole race of people or that whole group of people, and you can justify it. There's a quote here from John Gray, which is that book I'm reading at the minute that we were talking about on our Discord channel with the membership. It's a book called Straw Dogs, Thoughts on Humans and Other Animals. And he says in there, genocide is as human as art or prayer. And he's essentially making that it's just inbuilt in us, this death anxiety and things. That's such a human thing. That something like genocide isn't actually that surprising, really. It's just built in us in a way.
It's a very, you go along, this is it, what I got from Becker as well. Like, you go along, like numbing yourself a lot of the time and getting busy and thinking that you are quite moral at times as well. But I think we've all sensed that when we get fear, or we get hyper, or feel a bit pointless, or someone's attacked us, or it looks like we're going down, then your so-called morality and your ethics obviously change pretty quick, especially, you know, if you've been attacked, you better attack back. Attack is the best form of defense type thing, isn't it? You know, if I do this, you can rationalize it, it's for the greater good. So yeah, I think that's interesting. So do you think that with COVID, that, you know, like people have said, oh, I kind of, after COVID, I had a rethink about my life a bit. You know, some people have, a few percentage of people, rather than it being like, do you think death came into play there because they started to sit down and think about their whole life as a whole, and they've only got limited time, and therefore what am I actually doing with it?
Yeah, and maybe it wasn't as conscious as just the thing of, because a lot of people, you know, for example, they started working from home, didn't they? So then they realized, actually, that commute's like, does my head in that, like, why am I doing that every day? And just that maybe their working life patterns change. So there was definitely loads of that in play. But I wonder if this was more the subconscious, so they maybe didn't consciously start thinking, well, I've only got, well, what, best case scenario, I've got 35 years left here. Do I want to be dead? I don't maybe think that was in play, but subconsciously, Becker's theory would say, yeah, that was massively like the organism sensing that. And therefore, yeah, maybe they do start thinking, right, I'm going to sack this job off because I don't feel fulfilled. It's not going to give me any legacy. What's the symbolism that I'm going to leave behind just from working in an office for the next 20 years? Maybe some of that comes in, I don't know.
There was a saying, like, you tranquilize yourself in the trivial, you know.
Yeah, so I brought that up because apparently Kierkegaard talked about that quite a lot back in the day, and I think Heidegger's spoken about it in some of his work as well. And essentially what Kierkegaard was saying was that when we have this death anxiety, we essentially just like fall into these modes and patterns of just like unconscious behavior where you're not really self-reflective. And one of the ways we do that is we just busy ourselves. So we just get busy with like the mundane things in life, filling up your calendar and filling up your days with as much stuff as possible, even though it's just dead mundane and boring and doesn't require much thought. because it just keeps your mind off thinking about death, basically. So that was definitely, that was what he meant by tranquilize with the trivial. You just get busy. And Sheldon Solomon, who in the Worm book that I mentioned earlier, he has a great phrase I like called, he calls them culturally constructed meat puppets. that's what he was mean getting at, that we tranquilize ourselves with the trivial. So he's saying those meat puppets, basically, like, you just kind of live your life as a caricature of a stereotype of a particular social role. So if you're a sports coach, you just busy yourself with doing all the stuff that a sports coach does, and as much of it as possible, so you don't really, you're not being yourself or reflecting and thinking, like, taking ownership.
Job, not you as a person.
Yeah, and it's just a way of checking out of that thought of, like, death anxiety and stuff. And the other way that I suppose we do that the terror management book talks about as well, is we consume stuff. So we just passively consume. So that's why shopping's such a big thing. It's a way to, again, get rid of that death anxiety, sitting in front of the TV watching Netflix, getting into your sports team and just watching sport. They were all ways of escaping this conscious engagement with the fact that you're going to die one day. It's a way to hide from it.
Reflecting on myself, I always feel good when I buy something, you know, not always for the thing I've bought, in a way. It's weird, isn't it? And then the other thing is I like burying myself into ideas a lot, and books and new information and chatting and debates and WhatsApp chats and deep conversations, because in a way that also, I know it's got a cathartic, tranquilizing effect, you know, having a cup of tea, doing things, what you might, but so actually in a way they're very important for me, because that's what makes me tick and calms me down. And other people might go, God, he's crazy and his brain's going all the time, he needs to do some meditation. And I'm like, no, my meditation is doing, chatting to you on WhatsApp for 25 minutes, or responding to, you know, an email or something, that or writing in a book, like, you know, just, you know, going for a run. So I try and do it whether it's a win-win or there's a win-win-win, you know, so it's productive and it probably is contributing as best as I can to maybe my legacy in a way. So that's quite good, doing a PhD, doing a book, or entering a race, or, you know, coaching people. But I am also slightly aware I'm just filling in time where that's not nervous time. You know, I'm doing stuff. And this thing about, you know, people are human beings, they're not human doings. Well, I don't see it as simply as that anymore. I see it as, like, being a human being is being a human doing, you know.
Yeah, human beings do stuff, definitely. But it's, I think the key with that is you don't just become a human doing, and you don't ever think about why you're doing it and what you're doing. You're just doing it to stop being a human being almost. You're more like a robot, aren't you, then?
Having that self-awareness of perhaps when you're just doing stuff, like, you're just stuck in it, like, you are that role, you know, rather than, I'm choosing to do this, I know what I'm up to, I'm just being busy today writing this book. It really doesn't mean much, but it means a lot to me. But to be fair, it's killed 5 hours, and I know when I've come off this computer, I'm going to be buzzing and have a cup of tea, and I feel miles better than if I just sat there doing nothing. You know, so the absurdities of going to play golf and investing in being, you know, and all these things, I think it's very important before you go accusing people of what they're up to and their habits and why they do things. It's like, if they're just ticking along and they're being healthy and they're not going insane and they're staying, you know what I mean? Even like your mum when you're shopping, maybe that's just making her feel a little bit more like a mum or a wife or something, or a housekeeper, like that little part of her that makes her feel better. Whereas from our perspective outside, we go, what are you doing that? You might be saying, like, what are you doing? You know, bloody...
Well, she would. One of the...
So you're as crazy as I am. I'm filling in time. You're filling in time. No.
Yeah.
And you can go, no, but my time's been filled in better than your time doing that. You're stupid. And she goes, well, you're stupid. And so I've learned that a bit, that, like, these things, like this stuff. And one thing was interesting. Well, I worked with an athlete a long time ago, and they were about to retire. So this is about athletes. You know, they say athletes die 2 deaths. So this is interesting. Not going, you know, a bit in our book, isn't it? You know, they're going, oh, you know, I'm going to have to retire at 34, 35, and I'm 28 now, and I'm 29. Oh, and you talk. And one time one player said to me, I just fear being forgotten. I fear being irrelevant. I fear coming to a place like this and nobody knowing who I am. And I thought, what a really weird thing to say. Like, get over yourself. Like, you've had great success. You really, I was a bit shocked, you know, because this person was, you know, larger than life and really successful. I was like, what a weird thing to say. But having read this, I've kind of now, I thought, well, they were onto, they knew, you know, they were just saying. And I think that, like, that's what you might say, like, oh, you know, you had a great time being an athlete, you retired, just move on. But some people find that difficult because they fear that impermanence, they fear that they're going to be forgotten. And I think by actually acknowledging that and understanding it and not treating it as stupid and getting out in the open, I think that's where these ideas can help you a bit. You can say, yeah, well, I get that because we all fear death in a way and da-da-da. And I think it's a good kind of structure to have a conversation. You're not weird because you're feeling like you won't matter. It's kind of what Becca was saying. Everyone fears. But you're just like so high a life at the moment. But you have to let it go and maybe we can deviate into these other areas and it doesn't have to be so dramatic. You do live on. There are other things you can do. And when you hear athletes like Paul Laurie, the golfer I was hearing this morning, saying very went through different phases of his life, talk. I said, yeah, I wanted to carry on playing, but I wasn't as good and I couldn't do this. So I play a little bit, but I started this foundation, then I did this, then I moved into that. It was really nice. So I think that's interesting. But one of the other bits was with athletes I noticed was like some people, and this is not just athletes, but could be jobs, they tranquilize themselves. I've seen when they lose in sport or things don't go quite as well, or they fear that, you know, then the rivals are doing better or whatever. Sometimes they go back to training or they go into analysis or they do it because the disappointment and the pain of losing and whatever is so much that they just go back into the mundane like mode of training. They rarely take time away because it's too painful to like have a gap sometimes. They might go and get drunk or they might go and, you know, and so on. But I see a lot of people like in sports that they'll go out into the daily grind of being busy in just training. They'll train and train and train and train and overtrain and be professional and all those things. Now, it's like there's two modes to do that. There's willpower. You know, this was something Simone Biles talked about, wasn't it? There's the willpower way of doing something. Like, I will get fitter. I will get better. I will stop this pain. I will be... And then there's another way of thinking about it where you can almost handle the fact, you can take a step back, hold the being a bit, hold the misery, hold that fact that you're not playing well, contemplate on that a little bit, and perhaps creatively you'll come up with a different solution about where you now need to go to fix this rather than just razzing back into your job.
This is where I think I saw Sheldon Solomon, who I mentioned, who wrote, or was part of the team who wrote the Worm at the Core book. I've listened to a few interviews with him and I really love his vibe, actually. He's got a really nice way about him. He's a proper, just seems proper sound, even though he's an academic, just got a really nice vibe about him. But I heard him on one of the things that I listened to, it might have been a TED talk even. He was explaining this kind of modern self-help craze around that, exactly what you're saying. He's like, people are drowning themselves in like self-help books, you know, like we take the piss, like airport books and things. And that's kind of part of it. It's like all these books, listening to all the like motivational speakers and like the time management gurus, it's like that's become like a new religion. And it's almost because it's like you need to do as much as you can in your day as possible before your time eventually runs out. It's inevitably going to run out. So he was saying that's maybe in play with it as well, where you see it all the time. You know, like David Goggins and people like that. Do you know what I mean? That you'll see them like motivational videos and it's like, what are you doing today? I'm like, I've already run 17 miles by the time you've even got out of bed. And like, you know, it's all like motivational and it's quite aggressive. It's like, make the most of every single second, otherwise you're a disgrace. Right, yeah. I think Sheldon Solomon was like, no, you need to, like you're saying, you need to just chill out a bit sometimes and actually just go and lie on a beach and just do nothing. Yeah. And just like be yourself, and just be like a human being. It's not wrong. You don't have to, every second doesn't have to be scheduled and maximized. Everything's about optimization, isn't it? And measuring. And like, you can get an extra 4 minutes of deep wave sleep if you do this every morning. Everything's just like too much. Just chill out a bit.
I see it as, if you're suffering a little bit in anything, you know, a bit of pain, a bit of misery, a bit of existential weight, a bit of boredom, a bit of something that's not like on it. You know, it's like, I'm not used to this feeling. I need to eradicate it now. So you dive to the self-help book or you dive to the action. You can understand why people do that and you don't want to like have too much of that pain. But some of that like pain helps you in the long run, because Simone Biles said, another philosopher, you come up with a creative solution to that problem in your contemplation and take coming away, rather than just going into a willpower solution and just more. So I'm just going to get back to work. I'll be fine when I go back in on Monday.
That's more tranquilizing, isn't it? You're just tranquilizing the feeling.
Overaction and overcommitment, like if you know, like just keep pouring the water in the jug and keep it overflowing. It's like no, let it empty a bit so that there's some space left for the new water to go into. Like you're just a busyness type project, and like you've lost that game now. Just sit around for a bit, watch the rest of the matches. You're out of the tournament. Feel the pain a little bit, because in that pain, in watching it, in that depression, for not bad depression, you know, in that contemplation, and you might come up with a different vibe or a different feeling or a different solution. Maybe this is what you did have the time on holidays, or you do have the time in COVID to sit and ponder and make some shifts, because it was the first time you got to slow down enough and maybe not completely, you know, like get on projects and fill.
But you saw people go 2 ways, didn't there? Some people absolutely loved that and were like, this is amazing, I can do stuff that I've never been able to do. And other people absolutely hated having that, not having a schedule and not having a calendar of like appointments and things to tranquilize that feeling. Just like, well, I don't need to think too much about what I'm going to do, because this is what my job tells me to do. So I just do that, the trivial stuff. So I wanted to mention, it was probably one of my biggest issues with the book as a whole. It's obviously of its time, so it was written in the 70s, 1973. So Sigmund Freud is still a big name in the scene, you know, psychoanalysis, the subconscious, all that stuff was still very much in fashion. And Becker does focus on Freud a lot. I don't think he actually really liked him that much, but there's so many chapters where he's just banging on about what Freud said about this and what it means from a denial of death perspective. So really what Becker was doing in a way was he was putting a bit of an existential spin on Freud's assumptions around psychoanalysis and the subconscious, etc., the unconscious. But it got a bit weird. So in the book, I think I maybe texted you one of them. He says things like, this is Becker, things like we feel guilty about sex because that reminds us that we're creatures. So he calls it reminds us of our creatureliness. So that's what he was making the point, or he was positing that's where people get like fetishes from, because it makes them feel a bit more unique and it's their own special thing that they've decided, rather than just, no, you're just an animal subject to basic instinctive desires and drives and stuff. So that was a bit of a weird one, which he says over and over. He kind of repeats just over and over in lots of different ways, making the same point. Another one that was really, really weird was he talks about anality, which he's basically saying the fact that we have to basically shit as human beings, and you see that come out of you and you look at it in the toilet bowl. This is really weird. He was saying that creates this death anxiety because it like levels you, it brings you down to earth, and it like it's in your face that look how quick that can just disappear. So he talks about when you're a kid and you first realize when you flush the toilet and it disappears. He's making that link from a Freud perspective to that reminds you that you're going to get flushed away one day and you're just going to go back to the earth where you came from. So really weird stuff around that I found. Yeah, it's just going over the top now to make his point. And the other thing that I thought was a little bit of a misstep, obviously, like we've talked about Heidegger quite a bit and he's one of the philosophers we like, he does mention him very briefly, but then like I say, he moves on to Freud and it's like, you're missing out here, Becker. Like Heidegger had way more stuff that was interesting around this perspective. So I think we will have talked about in the Dasein episode we did, you know, this notion that we're beings towards death. And, you know, Heidegger was massively onto that, you know, spend more time in graveyards and everything and embrace it rather than ignoring that fact. So you would have thought there was loads there for Becker to go into around that, just that human being aspect again, which he doesn't. He just touches on it and then he moves on. Because if you think the stuff we talked about, like the productivity gurus, but think about like the life extension gurus now as well. You know, like you see some of these guys in Silicon Valley and they're taking like a million supplements a day, all these like devices they've got on different portions. It's all to extend the life as long as possible, which was very much roundabout. It was with, that's more Heidegger for me, that stuff, you know, the you're running from that fact rather than some of the stuff that Becker gets into when he's going on about bloody anality and stuff, try to link it to Freud.
I listened to something and it was a take on it. And again, it could be like a Freudian type, you know, deep, mysterious thing.
I'm not a fan of Freud, just like my cards are on the table.
Yeah, it sounds good, doesn't it, a lot of it? And it's been disproven, and it's more fantasy, isn't it, really, than anything. But, you know, anyway, it could have worked for some people, we'll see. But there was an idea, even with Becker and Freud, and this mentor and mentee thing. So because he got a lot of ideas from him originally, then what you got to do is almost like, I don't know whether you've had this in your mentor and mentee stages of life. I've seen it with things that we like the idea of if we've idolized somebody or worshiped somebody in our life, and we've gone, they're amazing, I love them, they're you know, they're like everything that they tell me, they know, you know, I'm going to be like them, I'm going to copy them, and so on. Comes a point where like you feel a bit like, I want to outgrow that now, especially if that person drops in your esteem. If you think, actually, I've looked behind the curtains, they weren't all I thought they were, right? There's this thing then, again, that you like want to turn your back on them so that you don't feel as stupid. So you actually want to bring down your mentor, right? You know, now I'm trying to think of when I've actually done that. Maybe I have, I can't, but I've had it done to me with a lot of teenage lads and and they get to 21 and you've helped them loads, and then you don't hear from them for like 10 years or whatever. They're busy doing their lives, and you get this vibe that like, I don't need you, like, yeah, because they like want to strike out on their own, and that's cool, right?
Yes, for your name to stand, you have to feel like you did it yourself. If they think, oh yeah, but that's only because you worked with him for 10 years and he like held your hand.
Yeah, you give a nod to them. You say, oh yeah, I used to knock about with that guy. He gave me a couple, but I've created this myself. And maybe that's what you do with your own parents sometimes, your father, you know, you go against them. So now that's Freudian, isn't it? In terms of like, you know, some sort of whatever complex you might have about so on. But it's also, I just thought it was interesting, and I have seen it play out. I've seen it where mentors have been sort of kicked out by their mentees once the mentees got enough strength to actually almost sometimes go the other way and put them down, ignore them and blast their arguments. And I think Becker does that with Freud a lot. And I think you see that in philosophy a lot, don't you? The next philosopher who takes their idea on has to sort of show that they can kick them down, that they're not totally just another like carbon copy of them, because I'm original and I have things to say as well, you know. And I've had that with people, you know. And then hopefully in the end they come back and they go, I just went through a phase, I was being a bit of an idiot.
But it all comes in, doesn't it? Like, so the status games episode and all that's in the mix, isn't it, around? And then if you imagine, then you've got this massive subconscious existential weight that's just on us all the time, that we're going to die. You see how some people lose the plot?
The flip side for me, if I thought about it, so, you know, well, I was trying to think, well, what's the alternative to this? Because it sounds all encompassing.
Let me put some questions at you first and then we'll finish it up with that, because I just had some ideas that I thought, these are just my observations that I noted down thinking. So one of them I was thinking, if you think how many people are on medication these days, for like all sorts of different like chronic illnesses and stuff, and I was like, God, that's every time you take a pill on the morning for a thing, that's a constant reminder of death, isn't it? So I was thinking, I wonder if it's like, you couldn't ever measure it really, but I wonder if you did put it on a trend, it must be higher, because people are living longer because of like surgeries and medications and stuff, but in a way it's still constantly reminding you of the fact you are gonna die. So I thought that was interesting. Another interesting thing that I got to thinking about was, is that, you know, like the growth of like technology and artificial intelligence is huge at the minute, isn't it? And just like the way that technology is just constantly like growing and quicker, we're getting more and more detached from nature. So a bit of that was Becker, where he was saying that we don't like to spend too much time in nature, because again, it reminds you that you are actually part of the ecosystem and from nature yourself, but whereas we like to think ourselves as separate to it, don't we? And more machine-like because of the science and technology we've got. So do people spend less time in nature and out because it reminds them of death and the fact you're a creature with a finite body?
Really interesting, because I was walking around the wood that I always go around the other day. When I got Woody, you know, when he was tiny, as a puppy, the dog, he used to run in this tree trunk that had come down and it had hollowed out. We'd been eaten. And I was back in the woods the other day, and I was with Leo this time. We were on Woody, and we were just walking around, and he was full of mud, and I was falling over. It was really nice being in the woods. And I came across this log where Woody used to go in, and it had really disintegrated to not much. Did give me a strange feeling. It was a bit like, you know, because like, dog gets older, doesn't it? And your dog only lives 12, 15 years. That's on your mind a bit, you know, because, oh my God, he's going to go. It's not even a full one. Then I'm like, I'm a father and Leo's young. He's got his whole life and I need to be there for him. So it was weird how that moment, that little ping was like, oh, you know. So at that moment, I probably picked out my phone, took a picture of something and sent it to someone. Exactly the same. You know? Nature is powerful that way, isn't it? It can lift you. And yeah, that when you see decomposition and things getting old around
in your soul,
bit, whoa, or your neighbors getting older, there are all these reminders that it's like you see a photograph of yourself and suddenly you look young in the same photo that's been there for years. You think, God, I was young there. You know, it's like, yeah. I mean, photos are changing as you're looking at them. And it's like, it is around. Like you said earlier, I'll go to another place I walk, a brilliant walk, but it's in the middle of the whole fields. There's a cemetery, and it's always, hearses are always going past with people behind.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm thinking, when am I going to be in that car? You know, it flitters through your mind. And then, but the funny thing with that is, this was the Heidegger bit. He said that can actually give you a boost. That can wake you up and go, you know, the old get busy living or get busy dying, isn't it? So then you can go, right, no, like, come on, put it. Get positive. And while I'm here, let's wake up, and life's too short to have that argument with that person. Many a time, you know, when that's happened and I've had those moments, I will ring somebody in my own head I'd fallen out with. I'll just ring them like, life's too short, just give them a ring. And then you ring them, everything's great. But had I not had that kind of wake up, I'd have carried on with the, you know, imaginary argument we were both having.
See, I honestly see it as a positive. So like I said at the start, the title and just the book, you can come at this and think, oh my God, this is going to depress it. But I genuinely see this stuff as a really positive, optimistic, just empowering thing of like, no, you can actually transcend yourself in a way to overcome it. So I ended up, when I was, it's like, yeah, what do I think about death and stuff? And my conclusion was, death honestly doesn't bother me really. What I want to avoid is pain. And I was like, that would be way worse for me to live a long time. I can't deal with pain really. I'd like the slightest thing, to be honest. I'm a bit of a fanny, but that aspect of, yeah, like I just want to avoid pain for as long as possible. So if I can get to 75 pain-free and be able to do what I want, I'd take that over 90 and like decrepit and just like your existence is pain, like physical pain, I mean, or mental, I suppose. But yeah, that's where I thought, I was like, yeah, it's pain for me. Death doesn't scare me. But if anything does, it's the thought of like living in like constant pain that's like just constantly there. That wouldn't be a good thing for me. But the death thing I see is like an optimistic, no, like Heidegger, like you say, this is right, my time is finite, so let's go and do what I want to do. Doesn't have to have much meaning after that. Like we said last time, the sun's going to explode the earth at some point. So I'm not bothered about a legacy.
I'd first heard of Becker listening to Jordan Peterson's lectures years ago. So when he came up on, like, you mentioned him and, you know, and I think he'd been on a podcast as well. It was, like, already in my head a bit. So I was like, oh, yeah, I've heard of that. And it was a bit interesting. I can't remember. I'll go read about it. Anyway, I went back to the Peterson bit and I found it. And he's just on YouTube, you know, 10 minutes. He criticizes and says, look, I love Becker. It's an amazing book. I've used it. I love most of it, but my big criticism of it is there are worse things than death. Like, there's hell. Why have humans invented the concept of hell? Pain. He says, and also people you love dying, things you love dying more than you. That's it. And he goes on to say pain is the only real thing in the world or something, you know, it was something else. But so that was interesting. So Jordan Peterson's criticisms of Becker were quite interesting to a point. And then, you know, the little counter criticisms of Becker theorists and people. So it's just a debate, isn't it? I think that for me, I was thinking that some people actually try and do like near-death experiences on purpose, don't they? They love thrills. They love jumping off things. They love like the risk of stretching themselves like close to adventures where it's dangerous and going on. There's an element of the fact that they could possibly die on the adventure that makes it more rewarding if they get through it. So they go to uncharted territories and, you know, do risky things, climb heights, you know, get the thrills by tempting death and things. So I didn't see it as that people are always denying it. Some people embrace it naturally and like use it, and have, like, you know, the different personalities, people that are maybe don't like, when we did our very first podcast, the alpinist, he didn't like think, oh god, gonna die one day, I better get climbing some mountains. He didn't even enter his early life. I'm not that kind of person, really. We're just here, and I've got to climb mountains, it's in my bones.
But I wonder if the issue is he reminds other people of their death. So the fact he's doing all this mad, crazy stuff that he could die doing, that reminds his friends and his family when they see him, like, of their death, doesn't it? It's like, why is he putting this in my face? And that's when maybe we don't like those kind of mavericks.
So when you're watching him hanging off that ice shelf, even you, who's not bothered about death, as you say, was going, oh, like, you know, shivering in your seat at home. Putting yourself there like he was, so there must be, that's the truth of it, isn't it? And I think someone said, like, you can talk about all this stuff until it's you. So really, you don't really know what you would do in reality. You might not know how much you did love living until you nearly lost it, kind of, you know. So it's easy to say, well, you know, I used death in this way, very functional, very philosophical, blah, blah, blah. But when it's actually you, and that's the weird, mysterious thing about it. So that's where I criticised Becker as well. He took something really weird and mysterious in there, whereas Heidegger just said, it's there, that's Dasein, that's part of being a human. He didn't really go on and say, so that means this, that means this, that means this. He psychoanalysed it on Becker, and really gone, we're using Freud, and he's made all these sort of assumptions, like we've talked about mainly today, that in a way we don't really know is true. But they're ideas, and if the idea's out there, going back to pragmatism, you know, try them a little bit for that time. You can, it's a plausible story, you know, and then the other guys have got the evidence on it. So I don't think it's totally just a story and all. I think there's something in it, but again, like all these things, it's not all things to all people, is it?
And it goes full circle. So like we've been saying, or I was saying to you recently, there's not a lot that the ancient Greeks didn't already have cracked. So if you go back to, I think it was Socrates, through Plato, obviously, I think, said to philosophize is to learn how to die. Yeah. And it's the same thing, isn't it, really? That's why, like, the chats that we have and the things that we do on ThinkSpace and stuff, that is it in a way. Maybe it is some of it. It's all the philosophical chats and discussions are maybe just like dealing with that subconscious finite thing, and we know we're going to die. And that's why philosophy is helpful. It helps you deal with that and then attack the world rather than succumb.
That's, I feel like that, I must admit. I kind of know, I've got into philosophy the last 5 years or so and done studies in it. I find it really interesting. I do want to understand it to help, practically help sports people and myself and people I love, and be a better person, you know, and understand it. And it's interesting, so it does that psychological sort of stimulation that I like. But yeah, ultimately, what's the reason of it? It's a soother. It gives you consolation. You're hoping that it's going to be helpful, but I still have this sense that it'll all collapse when it really matters.
I thought you were going to leave us on a really positive note.
I kind of know that it's all built on matchsticks. You know, it's all like, yeah, you're learning how to die and all, and you know, the Buddha and all. Yeah, because you've seen that, haven't you? I saw that. You read books where people have gone all the way into the extreme buddies of all the way. They're still idiots and pissed off, and you can't escape it. But if it helps a bit, but saying that, like, that's just me. If you were really, truly into religion, and if you truly believed in that, then there might be this letting go. But I tend to find that with a lot of people, it's a natural aging process. You know, hopefully you don't care as much the older you get. You know, that's the best you can hope for, I think. So you have a much more of a natural self-serious thing, and don't need, I think the thing for me, you don't need to get obsessed about that fictitious symbolic self. You can lighten up about your symbolism, because you've done some things and you've done that, you're a good person, but you don't have to totally obsess about it. So if anyone comes attacking your beliefs and your theories and all them things and what you've achieved, or they pick holes in it, or they find some things in your skeletons in your closet and they throw them at you, maybe you can just go, yeah, to be fair, you know, a bit more than you would if you were hyper obsessed about your legacy and that symbolic self. So you don't take yourself so seriously.
And if anything, and I think I've said this to you before, it's quite egotistical to want something to survive after you die. So it's maybe that's how I see it. Something like, yes, get out of your own backside. Why does it matter? Like, you're not that important. You just do what you do while you're here, and that's enough. You don't need anything. That's egotistical to want more.
Yeah, I had my time in the light. I played around, was famous for 5 minutes, did a few things. That was good. I was important, but really I'm not, you know, and what matters is this. I know everyone's different, but you know, you grow old gracefully. You still have ambitions. You still have things that make you tick. You know, you still have your little highs and lows and your meaning, and you're still going, you're still energized, and you're still helping people and contributing. You're not like giving up and just, you know, like a beach whale, but you, to the end of your days, you're finding purpose and meaning in things. But in terms of the grand legacy of who you are and the symbolic self and what you stood for and who you, how many kids you had and all the money that you left behind, big deal.
Like we said, the sun's blowing that up, so crack on. Crack on. Okay.
When we dance, the journey itself is the point. When we play music, you will simply become completely absorbed in sound. And therefore you will find yourself living in an eternal now in which there is no past and there is no future and there is no thing called difference between yourself and the world of nature outside you. This is red. This is green. This is something. This is nothing. This is solid. This is space. Between yourself and the world of nature outside you.